A novel that has you pondering one very big question. Would you want to know the date of your death?
I would only want to know it if it were good news, which is sort of the, you can't do it because if I were to find out, I wouldn't know if it were good news or not when I started. So I would say no, would you?
That's Chloe Benjamin. We talk with her about her best-selling novel, The Immortalists. Then, could there be people among us whose lifespan is nearly a millennium?
I invented this condition called anageria, which is this condition where from the age of adolescence, your body starts to slow down, so you're aging much slower. So for every, say, 15 years of normal human time, you're only aging one biological year.
That's Matt Haig. We talk with him about his latest novel, How to Stop Time. And finally, we talk with a great environmental philosopher and advocate, Vandana Shiva. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. Would you want to know the day of your death? And if you did, how would it change the way you live your life? That's the premise of Chloe Benjamin's terrific novel, The Immortalists. It's the family tale of four siblings who, when they're still children, visit a fortune teller who tells them the precise day they will die. Is it destiny or suggestion? How the four come to grips with this knowledge in four different ways animates the plot of The Immortalists. It's a fascinating notion, beautifully told by Chloe Benjamin. The novel probes the line between destiny and choice, reality and illusion, this world and the next. It's a deeply moving testament to the power of story, the nature of belief, and the unrelenting pull of familial bonds. In addition to The Immortalists, Chloe Benjamin is the author of The Anatomy of Dreams. Well, Chloe Benjamin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
This was just a terrific novel, wonderful read, and it centers around the whole issue of mortality, but it's called The Immortalists.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that title.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It's not a book of fantasy, and nobody in the book is actually immortal, but for me, it symbolizes this idea that we all have to think that way until we're confronted with our mortality, that there's an element of ignorance that goes into to human life for a lot of us, and that we kind of push the thoughts of our mortality away as long as we can.
The book opens in 1969 on the Lower East Side of New York City with four siblings who are children who are going to a fortune teller at the behest of one of the siblings, Daniel. The fortune teller gives each one of them the date that they will die. Now, how did you come to this extraordinary premise for your novel?
Well, for me, the novel is very much about uncertainty and how we cope with it. I think there's no greater uncertainty than mortality in a lot of ways. We have to put one foot in front of the other without knowing how long we have in the world. And so I thought, well, what if you could know? Would that be a blessing or would it be a curse?
And in this case, is it a blessing or a curse?
Well, somebody said recently, you don't make a great case for knowing. And I was like, well, that's fair. I try to have a diversity of perspectives in the book. So I think for some siblings, it is more of a, if not a blessing, at least a propeller than others. But yeah, I hope that readers will consider those questions as they work through the book.
So give us a brief sketch of each sibling before we go more deeply into their stories.
Yeah, well, the fortune telling episode takes place in the prologue, and then the book is divided into four sections, one for each sibling. The youngest sibling, Simon, is a gay man who moves to San Francisco. He runs away from home when he's quite young. That's not giving too much away because it's probably in the first 30 pages or so. And he lands, as I mentioned, in San Francisco in the Castro, where there's this burgeoning gay movement, gay rights movement. Clara, the next oldest, is a magician, and she winds up traveling across the country, stopping in small towns before ending up in Vegas. The third eldest sibling is Daniel. He is a military doctor during the Iraq War. And then the oldest sibling is Varya, and she is a scientist working on longevity, so extending the human lifespan. And she's working with primates in an attempt to do that.
So Daniel is the one who drags his siblings to this fortune teller. Why Daniel?
Well, you know, I think he's kind of he's the oldest boy. He's got a bit of an ego. He's you know, good at roping people into what he wants them to do. And he's really frustrated that summer. So it's the summer of 1969, and they feel like something is happening to everybody in the world except them, that they're stuck inside in this, you know, very tiny apartment. And meanwhile, there's all kinds of riots and music and, you know, these really vivid cultural moments that, because they're children, they're not really a part of. So he takes that as his motivation to get out and do something interesting.
So the siblings are really the focus of this book, but their parents also figure as an influence. Tell us a little bit about the background of these siblings.
Yeah, well, their parents are Saul and Gertie, and Saul and Gertie have been raised by immigrants. So like a lot of Jews at the turn of the century, their parents came from Eastern Europe to escape persecution. And so they bear that burden in the way that many children of immigrants do. Saul is a conservative Jew, as is the rest of the family, although the others aren't really very devout, and he truly is. He runs a family business that he inherited from his father, a tailoring business. And Gertie looks like a prototypical woman of the time, and that she got married and had children young, but she has a lot of ambition, and she feels a lot of mournfulness, I think, about having to give that up. And so I wanted to show how the pressures that Saul and Gertie inherited from their parents are ones that they can't help but pass down to their children, but perhaps with different results.
Yeah, and in some way, I think this book also has a theme of possibilities, both possibilities that are foreclosed, as well as the possibilities that arise when one has to deal. Well, let me just say, one of the characters, Clara, as you say, who becomes a magician, talks about how magic is the key to the world, and where the impossible becomes a possible. So talk a little bit about that and how, you know, maybe that's a shift from the immigrant parents, or from her parents who are, you know, belaboring under the burden of being the children of immigrants.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Gertie at one point in the book says, you know, what you have is opportunity. What you have is the freedom to make your own choices, even as she sort of undercuts herself at certain points in the book by making her wishes for their choices clear. But for Saul and Gertie, they didn't have so many choices. So I think ultimately the difference in between Saul and Gertie and their children is that Saul and Gertie really were bound to, you know, making traditional successes of themselves in order to maintain their place in the world as, you know, as Jews and as immigrants at that time. And their children have that much more freedom to make different choices. And you see them doing that.
Yeah. So now the book really centers around how each of the siblings reacts to the, I don't know if we want to call it knowledge or just simply prediction of the day of their death. And one character later says how it infects their life like a virus. And each has a different reaction that reveals something about who they are and their relationship to the others and to their family. So maybe without giving anything away, I wonder if you could give us an example of this.
Yeah, well, let's see. I think the siblings are, I think they're influenced by their individual feelings about the prophecies, and then they're also influenced by what happens to their brothers and sisters. And so you see the way that these things interact, you know, what their original orientation might be, and then how that changes as they look at what happens throughout their lives as a family. Trying to think of, was there one example that came to mind?
Well, for example, Clara. I think Clara is probably the greatest example of this, but in some ways, maybe all the siblings respond to the prophecy by trying to create a kind of either a ritual or magic, something, a talisman or something in their life that will protect them from the prophecy. And Clara does this through the means of becoming a magician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. Her worldview is this idea that that magic is not deception, it's not trickery, but that it reveals things about our reality that we might not always see or might not want to see. And I think at the same time, as you suggest, it acts as a kind of immunity for her against some of the scarier valences of the prophecy and of her own mortality.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Chloe Benjamin about her best-selling novel, The Immortalists. And yet, each one has to deal with, as Simon says, the thin line between fear and intuition. I really lingered over that phrase because it's actually a question I find me asking myself quite a lot these days, as we face such an uncertain future, a future that, you know, frankly, in many ways is terrifying to me. Yeah. And I have to say, am I just being infected by the fear, or am I really intuiting something that is going to happen?
Yeah, I really relate. I mean, that line is very personal. That's something that I struggle with all the time as somebody who's prone to anxiety. And, you know, I think that I sometimes am not sure where the line is between perceptiveness and sort of just projection, I guess.
So Varya and Daniel are very different than the younger siblings. They seem in some ways to go more toward the anxiety, the search for security, whereas the younger siblings are looking more for freedom and fulfilling promise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a bit of a sort of younger-older archetype going on in the difference between Simon and Clara, who are much more adventurous, more experimental, and more reckless in a lot of ways, and then Daniel and Varya, who are more rigid, more bound by their familial responsibility, and who pick careers that are a little more conservative. So I think in looking at those two groups, the book is asking questions about what's the best way to live or the most fulfilling way to live. Is it, you know, toward Simon and Clara or toward Daniel and Varya?
You mean in the sense that none of us really actually does know the day of our death. And even if we did, you know, it might not really make any difference. And would it make a difference in how we live?
Yeah, I think it couldn't not. personally, I come back to this idea of the power of the mind, and that's another big theme of the book for me. I think that the mind is really incredible in its ability to influence reality, influence the body, and influence the courses that our lives take. So I think as for how it would influence us to know our dates of death, that would be really variable, but I can't help but imagine that it would do something.
Would you want to know the date of your death?
I would only want to know it if it were good news, which is sort of the, you can't do it, because if I were to find out, I wouldn't know if it were good news or not when I started. So I would say no. Would you?
I'm right with you there.
Yeah.
And yet it is something that confronts people, for example, who, you know, may have a history of Alzheimer's in their family. Do they take a test, a genetic test, to find out if they have the gene or not, or the breast cancer gene?
Yes, I think you're right. There's all this question right now about genetic testing, and I think that that's a really powerful tool. And for some people, it's something that makes them feel they have the knowledge to make decisions about their health. But it also, as far as I understand, it's still difficult for the technology to pinpoint if you will for sure develop a certain disease. I think it can measure likelihood, but not certainty. And so then does it, in the same way as a prophecy, kind of implant knowledge that might not come to pass?
Yeah. Varya says at one point in the book, can a thought make something come true?
Yeah, I mean, that is the section that I think most directly looks at the power of the mind. I suppose people will read the book and come up with their own conclusions, but there's this proverb in the book that says thoughts have wings. It's a Romani proverb, and I think that's really true.
What kind of proverb?
A Romani proverb. That's the ethnic group that the fortune teller is part of. And so this proverb that Daniel writes down on a receipt at one point in the book, thoughts have wings.
So another, you know, I guess part of this is, how does destiny play out? And does destiny require our own complicity to make it happen?
Well, I certainly don't know, but those were the questions that I was trying to process. Absolutely. You know, what's the line between choice and destiny, or fate and chance, and how do all of those elements interact in the course of a life?
Right. So are you working on anything else, Chloe Benjamin?
I am. I am, of course, too superstitious to say anything about it, but I'm looking forward to getting back to it. It's been a really wild and unusual few months for me, and so I think when all the hubbub dies down a bit, I'll be able to return to it.
Oh, that's great, and I hope that we can talk with you about the next book.
Oh, I would love that. Thank you so much.
Well, Chloe Benjamin, you're wonderful novel, just a terrific read, is The Immortalists, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you so much. This was such a treat.
Chloe Benjamin. In addition to The Immortalists, Benjamin is the author of The Anatomy of Dreams. Read an excerpt from The Immortalists by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, a novel about someone who lives for a millennium. Stay tuned. After the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Poor Tom Hazard. He suffers from the kind of loneliness and ennui that can only come when your life expectancy is 1,000 years. He's seen it all in the human condition, and it ain't pretty. Moreover, some very nasty people are out to get him. Into their laboratory, that is, so they can extract the secret of his longevity. He's one of a very small group of people born with a mutation that makes them live a very long time. British author Matt Haig explores the implications of such extreme longevity in his intriguing novel, How to Stop Time. It's a combination romance, a thriller, and a contemplation of our mortality. Matt Haig has written numerous books, both fiction and nonfiction. In addition to How to Stop Time, he's the author of The Humans and Reasons to Stay Alive. Well, Matt Haig, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your novel, which is just a great read, How to Stop Time, explores an unusual mutation that renders some people extremely long-lived with an average lifespan of nearly 1,000 years. How did this idea for a theme come to you?
Well, for ages, I just had this idea for a voice of someone who is really old. I have a narrative voice in my head, and I had no story whatsoever, and it took a long time for the story to bubble up. But the voice was the first thing that came, this old person. And then, you know, this was a long time before I invented this condition called anageria, which made it all make sense, which is this condition where from the age of adolescence, your body starts to slow down, so you're aging much slower. So for every, say, 15 years of normal human time, you're only aging one biological year. And so outwardly, you'd almost look and feel immortal because your face in the mirror isn't changing. And once I had that idea and explored the science of that, other things started to come into play. So I basically reversed, there's a real life condition called progeria, where you age too quickly, which is a horrible thing, which is a real thing, and it affects people. And so I took the science from that and kind of reversed it and imagined what anageria would be like. And I almost had to convince myself that anageria was real to sort of buy into the whole universe of the book.
Yeah, and so folks basically age normally up to puberty. Is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, that was partly because a lot of these kind of conditions develop at that time, but also because it would have created a hell of a lot more problems for me as a writer if I, if for instance, you were a baby for 15 years and then you were one for 15 years, you know, it would create, so that would be another book entirely. So it was a kind of get out clause for me, being honest, but also, yeah, there are conditions that sort of develop around adolescence. So as soon as I realized this could be one of those conditions, it made things a lot simpler for me.
Not to speak of if it were the other way, what a nightmare for parents.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And imagine being like 14 for 15 years. That would
be... Oh, my God. That would be worse than anything. So these, the world is, this is an unusual condition, but it isn't just your character who suffers from it.
No.
He is called an albatross. I guess the world is divided into mayflies, that's most of us, and albatrosses. Where did you come up with these two names for them?
Okay, well, the albatrosses are called albatrosses because at the time where this society is formed of these very long-lived people called the Albatross Society, albatrosses were considered in Victorian times to be a very, very long-lived creature. In reality, they rarely live beyond human years. I think the average age for an albatross at death is about 60 or 70. But in the olden days, they were considered very old and ancient birds. So I thought it would be quite realistic if you were coming up with the name in the 1860s to have albatross as a symbol of longevity. As for mayflies, well, most mayflies do live very, very, very short lives. Like, so I was thinking from the perspective of someone who was an albatross or an alba, a normal human life would almost be how we consider a mayfly's existence to be, where you can go through the entire life cycle in 24 hours, you know, that fleeting. And it was a nice way of looking at the sort of beautiful but fleeting nature of our own lives by thinking of a mayfly and thinking of ourselves as just mayflies who are here for a moment and to make the most of that.
So now your protagonist is one of these albatrosses. His name is Tom Hazard. For him, it's not just a blessing, but even rather more of a curse. Why is that?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm someone who's always sort of fantasized about immortality and for understandable reasons. You know, I'm quite a hypochondriac. I'm always worrying about dying of some deadly disease or something. So to imagine the opposite has always been a kind of fantasy. But with this book, it was quite therapeutic because I realized that if you actually did live for 500 years, there would be a lot of challenges to that. I mean, well, firstly, just practical things about how anything would feel new to you after a certain point. And also, if most people were mayflies, if most people were having ordinary human lifespans, it would make relationships difficult. It would make all kinds of things difficult. There'd be a lot of grief in your life. If you're wandering around the streets of London or New York, you would have seen a lot of changes over time, which would sometimes be good, but I think more often would contain sort of painful memories and stuff. So there are all kinds of issues to it. But I was taking him in quite a kind of miserable, grief-stricken place and trying to find within that some hope, because the idea was that if Tom, the central character, could find a reason to live and a reason to sort of embrace the present moment, then maybe I could, maybe other people could too.
I wondered, you know, about the title, How to Stop Time. I mean, you never really answered that. I wonder if you did just answer that and say living in the present moment is the way to stop time.
Yeah, towards the end of the book, he starts to explore this sort of, and obviously, you know, in terms of scientifically, he and none of us can stop time. I think the challenge more than stopping time is stop being ruled by time, stop being obsessed by time, stop being forever worrying about the future or regretting the past. I think from a very early age, one of my big theories in life is from a very early age, from school age, we're encouraged to live somewhere else other than the present. So, for instance, at school, school children are always practicing for tests, which is to put them forward for exams, which is to decide what college they're going to and what kind of employment they'll have at the end of it. And we're constantly encouraged to sort of think of the future, and then we reach a certain age where we're sort of mourning the past, and I think all of us find it quite hard to sort of be our kind of animal selves and inhabit the present moment. So this was my attempt at that in this book, I think.
And you said that he's grief-stricken. Why is that? I mean, and of course, don't say anything you don't want to reveal.
No, I mean, it's not really a spoiler because it's quite early on in the book, but he basically loved a normal person, someone who was a Mayfly, who wasn't, who didn't have anageria. So he inevitably lost the love of his life at a young age. He had a lot of years, decades and centuries ahead of that, where he was still mourning her, because no amount of time replaced the sort of intensity of his love at that young age. And also there were family members too. And one of the reasons he keeps his condition secret is he learns, I won't go into too much detail here because it is a bit sort of spoiler-ridden, but he learns at a very young age that it's dangerous for other people to know about his condition, because for all kinds of reasons. I mean, in sort of Shakespearean times, there was a lot of superstition about. So if you were suddenly seemed like you weren't aging, they would think of the devil and they would think of all kinds of sort of witchcraft going on. So it was a danger to people around him who knew about it for all kinds of reasons.
But the danger, you know, isn't just in those benighted times of superstition, but is a constant, even to the present day, because you go through the centuries. Why do you think the reaction to folks who would have this condition, anageria, would be so negative even in our own scientific age?
Well, I think partly because of that, partly because of the science. I think, you know, there are companies now, there are Silicon Valley firms and all kinds of things who are looking into aging and looking into immortality, and it's actually becoming a feasible scientific plausibility. We're not quite there yet, but of sort of regenerating cells and stuff. So if society suddenly discovered these people who live forever, then certain unethical people might take advantage of that or something. And also, I think it's just that general thing about being different. You know, part of what makes us human, or what we think makes us human, is our lifespan. And so if we suddenly presented with these people who comparatively were near immortal, would we precisely think of them exactly as human beings, or you know, at what point would you be becoming something else? And I think part of that is the to do with my own experience. Like when I was younger, I had very sort of mental health problems with depression and anxiety and stuff like that. And so I brought a lot of that to this, about how of a stigma surrounding mental health conditions. And I think, you know, and I was someone who looked like a normal, healthy 20-something-year-old, but I had this other life going on inside me. And in a way, Tom has this other life going on inside him. So there's a sort of parallel there, which I thought was fun to play with in terms of mental health or any invisible conditions that we may have.
And about the anti-aging movement, the push for, you know, finding, solving the problem of mortality of lung and finding longevity, what's your take on this kind of research? Is it something you think we should be pursuing?
Well, I think it's something that would create as many problems as it would solve. I mean, for instance, you know, in a world where our population is already massively swollen, if suddenly we found a way to live forever, I think that would create problems. I also think, as is the way of society, if we did discover this, at least in the short term, it would probably be only available to the super rich. So it would create all kinds of different inequalities and all of that as well. So I think there'd be scary sort of dystopian aspects to it. I mean, that said, you know, there would be probably all kinds of medical solutions, obviously, that would come with regenerating cells and things, and it would be very hard to say no to it if we were in pain or on the edge of death, to say no to the chance of not being. So as with all science, it's an ethical dilemma, I think.
Mm. So the billionaires would be the albatrosses and the mayflies would be the 99%.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would be a problem. Now, Tom Hazard, when we first meet him, he's applying for a job as a history teacher. And I just love this. I mean, you caught my attention right away because I majored in history in college. He's asked by his, you know, future employer how he plans to bring history alive to his students. But he answers that history is already alive.
Well, I mean, in terms of him, you know, I thought it would be very neat to have a history teacher who himself is history. So you can't have any more a better representation of history being alive than someone who himself embodies history. So he literally worked with Shakespeare. He met Scott Fitzgerald. He traveled the world with Captain Cook. He himself is history, and he was a historical witness. But also, yeah, in the general sense, I believe that's something that often sort of school and college and university gets wrong about history, or can slightly get wrong about history, is the idea that it's closed off, or that it's divided into periods which have little to do with each other. And I think if you live through so many different historical periods, each with their own little name, you know, often in the UK it's done by royal families like Tudors and Stuarts and stuff. If you live through each period, history wouldn't feel like that. It would feel like this line. You know, we've obviously, in our lifetimes, we've lived through, and we're living through a period of change now. But day by day, you know, the thread is there from the day before. So I think if you'd lived that long, you would understand history to be this very fluid thing, this very alive thing in the present, and to realize, to not have the arrogance that we sometimes have, or had until recently, that we're somehow at the end of history. You know, that the history is just a series of present moments.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Matt Haig about his latest work of fiction, How to Stop Time. Yeah, and he seems to ascribe kind of to the theory of the circularity of history. Is this true, or is this something that you feel?
Well, yes and no. I think you know, it's almost a bit of a cliche to say that history repeats. But I think, as with life, I think, you know, there's a kind of limit. There's a human spectrum, and everything operates within it. So I think, you know, the 20th century, the last century, had a lot of things which would have felt new because of industrialization. And I think this century also feels new, partly because of technology. But even with technology, there are repetitions. I mean, technology has always shaped and shifted society. Whether you go back to the original technologies like fire or the wheel or the plow, you know, society's always changed with technology. I think the danger is now is that by rate of change, mm-hmm. the acceleration of change is faster than it's ever been. So I think that is a new thing, not the change itself, but the speed of the change. And I think that's kind of the scary thing about the age we live in, but the fact that we're not essentially changing as human beings, but the world we're creating is, and quite fast.
Yeah, and far outstripping our ability to fully comprehend the consequences.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're still, you know, we haven't biologically evolved for about 30,000 years. And, you know, we're technologically, our technology is evolving and, you know, at a rate of month, you know, every month it's evolving. So, yeah, that's kind of scary.
So what kind of perspective on the human condition do you feel somebody like Tom, someone who will live 1,000 years, would have?
Well, originally I toyed with the idea of having him be this sort of almost old, wise guru figure. But when I was doing my research, I was looking at a lot of interviews with old people and, you know, their thoughts on life and stuff. And again, it comes back to this idea of repetition. I think the challenge with being that old, with being sort of 439 years old, would be the challenge of feeling something for the first time, the challenge of feeling something new. And I think that would be a kind of dilemma. Everything, it's not just society that would feel like it's repeating. You would feel like you were repeating. I can remember, he's not necessarily a writer I admire in lots of ways, but I remember an interview with Charles Bukowski a few years before he died, and it's available on YouTube, I think. But he's very interested about aging, and he says, you know, he doesn't feel like he's evolved or progressed in any way, and the challenge is that he's just feeling secondhand emotions and secondhand feelings all the time. So I think that's part of it. The challenge of being old, yes, you do learn things, but one of the things you learn, depressingly, is that there become fewer things to experience for the first time. And so, again, I think that's a challenge we all feel in our normal time frame, but would be an even bigger challenge if we live beyond centuries.
Yeah, I would imagine that too. But, you know, there's some research out there, and I can say, as being somebody who is older now in my life, that I think this is true, is that I think you get happier as you get older. I mean, after, you know, after the age of 60 or something, you become more peaceful generally with things. Is this something that you imagine for yourself as well?
Well, I hope so. I've done, this is going off on a tangent now, but I've done some research for a new sort of non-fiction book I'm writing about how the world makes us anxious in little ways. And one of the things I was looking at was fear of aging. And actually, one reason not to fear aging is that the older we get, the more accepting we get. Actually, the fear of aging is quite a young person's thing. And actually, there was a study done where they interviewed people in their 70s and interviewed people in their 30s and 20s. And the 70-year-olds were much more accepting of aging and much more optimistic about the future than the younger people were. So I do find that interesting. And also there's, I always forget her name, but there's a woman who was a palliative care nurse who spent a lot of time with people at the very, very end of their lives and looking at regrets. And the one thing that far overrode every other regret was the regret of fear. It wasn't ever a decision they'd made in their life that they regretted. It was a decision that they hadn't made. And it was, being bogged down by the fear of what other people thought about them, whether it was someone who had been, you know, in the closet all their life about their sexuality or whatever it was. They say fear was the thing that they wish they could go back to their younger self and say, just sort of live without fear. So I think that is certainly a wisdom and an acceptance that comes with time, and that just is not automatically there when you're younger.
Yeah, and that's something that your character Tom Hazard actually comes to as well in this book, How to Stop Time.
Yeah, absolutely, and he comes through it sort of during the course of the book, but it's taken him a few centuries to get there.
Yeah, and hopefully it doesn't. It won't take you or I that. Well, Matt Haig, it's just an eminently readable book. It's just wonderful. How to Stop Time. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you. That was a great conversation. Thank you.
Matt Haig. In addition to How to Stop Time, he's the author of The Humans and Reasons to Stay Alive, as well as other books. Find an excerpt from How to Stop Time at writersvoice.net. I'm a traveler of both time and space. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Vandana Shiva is a force of nature and a force for nature. Winner of the Alternative Nobel Prize, the Right Livelihood Award, Vandana Shiva has been at the forefront of the food sovereignty movement. Her greatest fights have been against GMOs and the patenting of seeds that have bankrupted small farmers throughout the world. As Vandana Shiva says, life is not an invention. She's the founder of Navdanya, an organization dedicated to protecting and promoting biodiversity, native seeds, organic farming, and fair trade. She's the author of more than 20 books, including Earth Democracy and Soil, Not Oil. The book Creative Civil Disobedience, out from French publisher Actes Sud and newly translated into English, is a series of interviews between Lionel Astruc and Vandana Shiva. It's one of a three-book series published to accompany the award-winning film Tomorrow. I called Vandana Shiva at her home in India. Vandana Shiva, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, your book, Creative Civil Disobedience, is being released as part of the Tomorrow series. Creative Civil Disobedience, first, tell us briefly about the civil disobedience movement that you spearheaded in the late 1980s, where you led some 500,000 demonstrators, tell us what they were demonstrating for and what the outcome was.
But I think to really understand the power of nonviolence, non-cooperation, and creative civil disobedience, one needs to go back to Gandhi and his term of satyagraha. Satya is truth, agraha is force. And we got our independence through people saying we will not be forced to grow indigo. We would rather grow food to feed ourselves, or we will not be forced to make our own salt, making illegal when the sea gives the salt for free, because the British had implemented a salt law. So when the new GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, was being negotiated, and in it had, at that point, three treaties that we knew would cause huge damage. One was intellectual property, where now seed was being redefined as an invention of more the Monsantos of the world, and they would then collect royalty from every farmer all this time. In the U.S., this royalty collection is $10 billion. From Indian farmers, they have taken 120 billion rupees and pushed them to debt and suicide. So the consequences are huge besides the ethical. But the scientific, that you don't invent a seed. You might put a toxic gene, but you're not creating the life form, because the life form creates itself. It's self-organized. It's autopoietic. The second agreement was agriculture agreement, which we knew would be about dumping. And we're talking about a cartel of poison sellers taking over the seed. They wrote the intellectual property agreement. A cartel of agribusiness wanted control over every day, our daily bread, Cargill. At that time, there was still a Continental, which Cargill bought up. And they wrote the agriculture agreement. And then the Nestle's and the Pepsi's and the junk food cartel had written the sanitary, phytosanitary, or food safety agreement. So when the agreement was leaked in 91, the director general of the GATT used to be called Dunkel. And this was called the Dunkel draft text. We called it DDT, like that lethal pesticide. And then I started to go to regions of India with these treaties, translated them into different languages. And in Bangalore, we organized a rally of 500,000 farmers to say food is too important to life to be left to the greed of these cartels. And basically, the government should not sign the agriculture agreement as being part of the WTO. This is what farmers' movements are still calling for. We have seen the disappearance of real food in these a little over two decades of this so-called free trade, which is not free for people. It's free for the corporate cartels.
Yes, in fact, you talk about in this book that the greatest danger is the concentration of power in the hand of this relatively small number of seed companies. You also brought to light in the early 2000s or maybe even earlier the terrible epidemic of suicides by small farmers. Talk about the link between what you're talking about now and that epidemic of suicide.
Well, till the WTO, 80% of the seed in India was farmers' own seed. Farmers were the breeders, they saved the seed, they shared the seed. Because of the GATT, I had started Navdanya, the seed-saving movement. And we had also partnered with networks and organizations, like those big rallies to say no to the GATT, no to WTO, no to agriculture in WTO. When the big giants took over the seed, they did it illegally because, A, they weren't allowed to enter India with their GMOs, and they used GMOs, genetically modified organisms, as an excuse for patenting. And I often say, for Monsanto, GMO means God move over. Basically, they brought in GMO BT cotton illegally. I filed a case immediately. I had huge threats from these people, but they eventually... You know, your government gets influenced. Look at your environment protection agency has become anything but protecting the environment. These corporations know how to corrupt governments and deregulate, dismantle the laws democratic struggles have put in place and responsible governments have put in place. So they came into India illegally. They lied to the Indian seed companies to say we have a patent, which they had in US, but not in India, because I have played a role with our government. I was in expert groups to draft laws. I worked with our parliament where we created a multi-party parliamentary group when we were forced, because of US threats in the WTO, to change our patent laws, which said there can be no patent in agriculture at all, and only process patents in medicine, we were forced to change. But because seed is not an invention and light is not an invention, our laws under 3J of our Patent Act said seeds, plants, animals are not invention, therefore not patentable. Process of modification, just the process, you can have a patent on it, but you can't own the seed itself and its future generations. Now, while the law said this was not possible, Monsanto lied to the Indian company, said, we have a patent. You've got to write licensing arrangements with us. You cannot sell any other seed but the BT cotton, which we license to you. And you will have to pay us this much royalty. Immediately, the costs went up. We intervened in the monopoly courts, in the antitrust courts. Prices were brought down. Let me give you a tentative assessment. Seed cost used to be zero if it was farmer's own seed. If they bought seed from the market, it was 5 or 10 rupees a kilogram. 60 rupees, 70 rupees make $1. Mm. By the time Monsanto took over the seed supply, cotton seed had jumped to 4,000 rupees, 3,600 to 4,000 rupees a kilogram. Of course, the technology failed because it's based on a totally wrong deterministic science. And the pests became resistant, new pests emerged. They then just added one more toxic gene. And as Einstein has said, a clear sign of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome. So they just added one more toxic gene, increased the royalty. That's when the Indian company said, you can't keep extorting this much money. We can't take more money from the farmers. The extraction from the farmers is what was leading to debt. The failure of the seed added to the crisis. The fact that these seeds were hybrids which needed irrigation meant that in periods of drought, they led to total failure. All of this meant more frequent failure, deeper debt, and the epidemic of farmer suicide. After the Indian company started to say, we can't keep paying more and more, Monsanto sued the companies. Last year, they tried to sue India's government laws, the Article 3J. I intervened in the courts, and I'm so happy to say just a few days ago, the Indian courts ruled against Monsanto's appeal to dismantle the laws that say seeds are not patentable. I think it's about the only case judgment in which this giant, corrupting, toxic giant, has lost.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with environmental philosopher Vandana Shiva. This is a web-only special from Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. That's so important because what you're talking about is the loss of the seed commons. Talk about the seed banks that you have put into place as a form of pushing back against this and saving our seed commons.
You know, that's exactly the reason. In 1987, when I first heard these companies, this was before the GATT, I heard them talk about how they had to own the seed. GMOs would be the entry point for patenting. They'd collect royalties, which would be the source of their profits. They'd have to get bigger, and they'd be a cartel of five by the turn of the century. And they'd have to impose these patent laws to force every government to impose patents on seed worldwide. That's why they entered the GATT and pushed those treaties. I felt a chill. I said, if five corporations control our food and health, where is the freedom? So on the one hand, I said, we're going to save the seeds. I didn't know anything about the seed. I have to make a confession. I own nothing. So I went to my parents' libraries because they were very, very highly educated, and their libraries had amazing books, including on agriculture. Pulled out those books, and then I would go to the villages where I had worked with the Chipko movement, the beautiful movement of Hug the Tree, and I've just come back from visiting Sundarlal Bahuguna and Bimla Bahuguna, the amazing leaders, facilitators of that movement. They're 90, past 90 now, old, and that's why one has to keep honoring them. But the villages of Chipko is where I went. I take the photos. I said, you have the seed. I tell them to collect it, save it, multiply it. Initially, it was all seed banks with farmers alone. Then we realized it needed a more structural process, and we have now created 120 community seed banks. I started much later the seed bank of cotton after the suicide started, and our seed bank in cotton is now supplying organic cotton seed. Farmers growing organic cotton are earning 10 times more. They're not in debt. They're pesticide-free, toxic-free, debt-free, suicide-free. And my dedication is in the next 30 years to work for an India where we have the true freedom. Of course, this will include not just the constructive work of creating community seed banks to reclaim not just the commons of the seed, but the commons of our mind, which, as you know, is being enclosed so fast between the Facebooks and the Cambridge Analytica to generate a new politics of hate and fear and manipulation, taking away the basic instrument of democracy as an expression of freedom. And now democracy under their manipulative control becomes an expression of unfreedom. The satyagraha becomes vital to remember that at any point of time, there are higher laws that act above the laws of greed, of brutality, of violence, of untruth, of post-truth. And those higher laws are the laws of creation, of the universe, of the earth, of Gaia, and the laws of our conscience and our fundamental human rights. And being human on this planet requires that we not cooperate with lower laws in order to protect the earth, in order to protect our humanity. And that's what we practice on a daily basis. That's what I practice personally on a daily basis. And we manage to keep Monsanto from perverting our laws, including when they take our government to court. I think the work still needs to be done. I dream for the day in the U.S. it's recognized that seeds are not invention. Your Supreme Court did a very ugly ruling on the case of Bauman, where Monsanto sued a farmer who had bought beans from an elevator and planted it. And they sued him and said, even if you haven't bought it from us, it's our seed, because seed is a self-replicating machine, and no matter where it is, how many generations down, it's still our property. That's a perversion of science, a perversion of human rights, and I'm waiting for the day, even in the U.S., there's a big uprising of the seed satyagraha, the kind of satyagraha we've done in India. I hope in the year of Martin Luther King's 50 years, of the civil rights movement, the civil rights of farmers will be defended. And we need to collectively work on stopping this obnoxious idea of farming without farmers, because farming without farmers means farming with fossil fuels, with chemicals in the hands of cartels, and that is not producing food.
Absolutely.
Food is produced by the earth, by the soil, by true seed. and loving farmers, and the loving hands and minds of farmers, and the relationship of those who produce food and those who eat food. We have to reclaim our seed and food. This seed freedom and food freedom is foundational to the freedom for the future.
One last question. You talk in this book about ecofeminism. I just can't let you go without asking you, what is ecofeminism?
Well, ecofeminism is just a simple recognition that we've been ruled by 200 years of capitalist patriarchy. The merger of the power of the fiction of money, the fiction of capital, because all it is an illusion. It's not real wealth. It's not the real cows on my farm. It's not the real soil and the wonderful land. It's not the seed. It is the extraction distilled into value in the hands of those who exploit. And every construct of capitalist patriarchy is removing the creativity and production capacity of nature and women. Ecofeminism is a simple recognition. Nature is alive, creative, produces everything that we need. Women are the ultimate creative force. Women, because they were left to look after sustenance as a result of the division of labor, not because it was in their genes, have become experts in sustaining. We need the expertise of sustaining. That's what ecofeminism is. And the movement Diverse Women for Diversity, we started a group of us in the mid-90s, both to enhance and support the Convention on Biological Diversity, to celebrate our biocultural diversity, as well as to deal with the World Trade Organization, for whom we said WTO for women means women, we take over now. We will decide what is production. We will decide what gets traded. We will decide what is value. We will decide what is meaningful work. Next year is 100 years of the International Labor Organization. It's 150 years of Gandhi. These are constant occasions to remember what are the real processes that sustain life, what is true freedom, what is real food, what is real seed. We just have to have a resurgence of the real.
I love that. WTO, women taking over.
Women take over.
Women take over.
So that Diverse Women Gathering is before, just before the International Biodiversity Congress. It's on 2nd, which is Gandhi's birth anniversary, the day of civil disobedience, and the 3rd of October on the Navdanya Biodiversity Farm in Doon Valley. I hope some of your listeners will be able to make it to this beautiful valley, which is my valley of my birth, the valley that I love and I want more people to visit.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, your book, Vandana Shiva, is Creative Disobedience, of which you have given us many examples here, and it's been such an honor to talk with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Vandana Shiva. We spoke with her about her work on the occasion of the publication of the book Creative Civil Disobedience, a series of interviews with her. Find links to the Biodiversity Congress and her organization, Navdanya, at writersvoice.net. And if you're listening to this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whichever podcast app you're using. It really helps to get the word out about this show. Thanks. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.